come to order. Present today, we have Representative Red Boucher, Representative Kurt Bernard, Representative Cliff Davidson, and Representative Dave Donnelly. The record should show that we are today missing Lyman Hoffman and Terry Martin. We also have a visiting legislator, Representative Bill Hudson. We're happy to have you with us. The first item on our agenda is a briefing on the Department of Military Affairs. And unfortunately, the commissioner could not be with us, but the deputy commissioner is. Mr. Chuck Borg is here, and he does have a slideshow for us, which he says will last about 12 minutes, and that'll still leave us about 15 minutes for questioning. Chuck.
Representative Ulmer, thank you for the opportunity to appear before your committee and talk about the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Take a few minutes to discuss the department structure, missions, responsibilities, and talk a little bit about our forecast for growth. I might mention that General John Schaefer gave this briefing to the new legislators last week, and for the sake of being repetition, I'll hit the highlights of it so that we don't put anybody to sleep here. The Department of Military and Veterans Affairs is that branch of state government responsible for the organization, operation, and employment of the Alaska Army and the Air National Guard, the Division of Emergency Services, and the Division of Veterans Affairs. The department also incorporates the Alaska Naval Militia and the Alaska State Guard. The department is one of the smallest in state government in respect to its state budget, but it's one of the biggest in terms of social and economic impact, and that's what the briefing is going to orient in on, because we feel that while the department is one of the most highly visible due to its uniformed association, it's probably one of the least understood when it comes to relation of state and federal mix and responsibilities, particularly as it applies to the money. We'll take a look at the department and how it's organized within the state and how it interfaces with the federal government. On the state level, the Adjutant General is the commissioner for the department, and he's Governor Cooper's senior military advisor. The governor's commander-in-chief of the Guard, and he exercises authority over those soldiers and airmen within the Guard in accordance with the state law. John Schaefer, General John Schaefer, as the Adjutant General, exercises command and control over the department on a day-to-day basis for the governor. Our department receives its primary budget from the Department of Defense through the National Guard Bureau in Washington, D.C. The Bureau's principal mission is to provide the resources to sustain active National Guard training activities. The Army National Guard and the Air Guard are the major two divisions within the department. So by virtue of their numbers of people, their facilities, equipment resources, and the budgets. However, we have the two other divisions that are equally important in their missions. Former Governor Bill Sheffield in 1984 established with Executive Order 58 the creation of the Division of Veterans Affairs, which placed a much higher degree of visibility on Alaska's veterans, and for the first time allowed the veterans to have voice at the cabinet level directly to the governor through the commissioner of the department. This reorganization was a result of the concern expressed by some of Alaska's 70,000 veterans, and this division provides a point of focus or contact to coordinate veterans' issues and programs with the federal and state agencies, the veterans' organizations, and the state's administration. The division consists of a director and a secretary headquartered in Anchorage. The fourth division is equally unique in its size and mission. The Division of Emergency Services. The Alaska Disaster Act of 1977 created the Alaska Division of Emergency Services within the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. This division is charged with the responsibility for coordinating all the state disaster response and recovery efforts. Since 1982, ADES has been responsible for participating or administering 43 disaster events, including the winter flood storms on the North Slope and Kotzebue, which occurred in late September of 86, and the one in October, which affected the Seward and Matsu Valley areas. Damage in these last two events was so extensive that the president declared them eligible for receipt of federal disaster assistance monies. And the cost of these disasters to date, not including the one in the Matsu and Seward, has run about $14.7 million, and best estimates on the disaster in South Central are $20 to $30 million at this point. That being three-quarter federal money. Historically, late fall, winter, and early spring are the periods of the greatest danger from natural disasters in this state. Training of public officials, both state and local, and emergency management and planning is an important part of ADES' responsibilities and activities. Since 1982, we've conducted six major training exercises involving all state agencies, as well as selected elements of the federal government and local Alaska communities. The purpose of these exercises has been to test and refine current emergency plans and to train key managers at all levels of government in disaster management. These training exercises paid a tremendous number of dividends during the recent major disasters on the North Slope and in South Central during the recovery and response and recovery efforts. During the same time period, the division has conducted emergency management workshops and public awareness sessions in 22 communities throughout the state. The Alaska Emergency Broadcast System is nearing completion. 18 plans for 19 local operational areas have been completed, and the equipment required to implement the statewide circuit is now being purchased and installed. The division has 24 employees with its main office in Wasilla. It maintains a duty officer and warning system to rapidly disseminate information and quickly dispatch emergency response people to any areas that may be affected. Briefly, our other areas of responsibility include the Alaska State Guard and the Naval Militia, both functioning and growing organizations. Both of these are called for by the Alaska State Constitution. Now I'll outline briefly our mission or reasons for existence. The department is a public service organization designed to support, serve, and assist Alaskans, particularly in time of crisis. To maintain an effective state readiness structure, the department trains people on a continuing basis using equipment and facilities provided largely by the federal government. Department programs benefit us in two ways. First, they provide valuable resources with which to use in responding to natural disasters, civil disorders, or emergency military situations. And secondly, the programs provide training opportunities and training enhancement for employers, plus they put payroll in the pockets of those participants. That payroll money is spread through all the local jurisdictions throughout the state. And of course, I need to add that one of the primary responsibilities, of course, of the Guard and the responsibility of the Adjutant General is to provide a combat-ready force capable of responding to enemies, wartime situations should that ever occur. These benefits cost the state little, as most of the training is federally funded. Take a closer look at the divisions of the department in terms of the individual missions and their personnel, facilities, and equipment budgets. The mission of the Alaska National Guard and both the Army and the Air is, as I outlined before, basically for public protection and to respond to any emergencies requiring protection of Alaska's territorial integrity in case of war. The recent rapid growth of the Army and the Air Guard in Alaska is a direct result of the increased attention being paid to Alaska by the Department of Defense in terms of Alaska's strategic value worldwide. We're unique up here in that respect because National Guard unit counterpart units in the South 48 prepare to go to war in Europe, Korea, or anywhere else where there may be contingencies. However, most of the units in Alaska are stationed at their wartime duty environment. In other words, the people in the Guard should ever be at war, go to war here. It makes a lot of sense because there's nobody better prepared to do the job than those people that are doing it on a day-to-day basis. As we take a look at the economic impact of the department, we'll look at the trends of where we've come from recently, where we are now, and where we're going to go in the future. Federal appropriations have grown consistently over the past 10 years to keep pace with the expanding role of the Guard. Roughly speaking, our budget for the department is divided into 12ths, with approximately 11/12 being provided by the federal government and 1/12 being provided by the state for approximately $6.5 million. much of that is federally reimbursed. Now, to talk briefly about what the state does and what the federal responsibilities are. The state government invests in recruiting, training, administering, and supervising the Guard members and providing maintenance of the facilities that are required. The federal government pays the salaries, approximately $51 million annually. They pay for the equipment facilities totaling nearly $500 million at the present, all the schools and training, the construction of those federal armories, support manning, which employs about 2,500 Alaskans on a part-time basis and another 1,000 on a full-time basis. Federal dollars are being dispersed in a number of ways for the Army Guard. In the personnel arena, for example, we have 590 full-time people who contribute about $23 million annually in payroll alone. The majority of the Army Guard is made up of the part-time or the traditional guardsmen who contribute another $9.3 million. The Alaska Army Guard has led the nation in the last 2 years in recruiting and retention. And the Guard Bureau and the Department of Defense have authorized significant growth during the next calendar year continuing over the next several years. This growth will have some far-reaching impact economically and socially throughout Alaska. For example, in percentage, it'll amount to 16% growth with approximately 489 positions part-time with a salary of $2 million with additional 73 full-time positions with an additional $3 million in annual payroll. Growth will include 113 positions in the MATSU, 19 in Bethel, 19 in Juneau, 17 in the Nome and Kotzebue areas, 54 in Fairbanks, and approximately 300 in the Anchorage area. We're also projecting growth for Kodiak and other areas as the missions expand. On par with the personnel growth has comes the requirement for facilities expansion and renovation of the National Guard facilities. For example, in the near-term program, we see expansions and renovations and new construction in Kotzebue, Nome, Juneau, and Anchorage totaling about $40 million. Last year, we had a federal program to upgrade federal scout armories in rural Alaska involving six rural communities. This summer, we'll see another four at about the same cost, $1 million going into those areas. We also have approximately $27 million going into facility upgrade in places like Fairbanks at $2.5 million, Wasilla Armory expansion at $2.5 million, and various other sites throughout the state. The point of bringing this out is that most of the contracts, in fact, we say 100% of the contracts that are going out to do this work that I mentioned go to local Alaska contractors, with about 50% of that money going into payroll for the construction workers. As the Guard has grown, so have the requirements for equipment. We've been fortunate in that recently we were one of six states to receive the Black Hawk helicopters. These were received in Alaska ahead of the active Army. Total Army Guard facilities and equipment has a net value or an inventory value of approximately $154 million. The Air Guard will celebrate its 35th anniversary this year. It started in 1952 with 16 people and one aircraft. Like the Army Guard counterparts, the Air Guard has led the nation in recruiting in the past 2 years. Present time, we have 330 full-time members who have an annual payroll of about $15.5 million, 700 part-timers who contribute another $4.2 million in annual payroll. Figures just mentioned do not include the recently activated 168 Aero Refueling Squadron in the Fairbanks area, which was activated on October 1. With 200 people, they'll spend approximately $5 million in that economy up there. And in the next 3 years, we hope to see that unit grow to about a 600 to 700 member, which will carry with it, will triple the size of economic impact infusion of federal dollars into that area. Air Guard facilities upgrade and new construction include $28 million for this new unit in Fairbanks, all federal money, and about another $7 million will be spent in the Anchorage part of the Alaska Air Guard. Again, most of this construction money, or all of the construction contracts and renovation contracts, are going to a Alaska businesses. Out-year building projections show us at about the $9 billion mark over the next 4 to 5 years. The Alaska Guard is one of 6 states to receive the new, brand-new C-130 Herc aircraft. They got them 3 years ago ahead of the active Air Force. The aircraft are worth $148 million. We were the first state, with the activation of that new unit in Fairbanks, to receive a new Air National Guard unit in over 30 years nationally. There have been reorganizations, but there's never been a new flag established. The 168 Squadron was brought online, as I mentioned, in October 1 of this year. These aircraft, the four of them, that like this one you see here, are worth approximately $16 million. Total Air Guard worth in facilities and equipment is about $212 million. The out-year growth we see expanding the C-130 unit to approximately 12 aircraft from its present 8, which will allow it to be expanded in other locales in Alaska, not just confined to the Anchorage area. And we hope to expand the numbers of this unit, that is a KC-135 tanker unit in Fairbanks, from 4 to 8 aircraft, which will triple the size and manpower of that unit there. Briefly, our other major divisions are budgeted with federal and state dollars. The Division of Emergency Services has 23 employees. 6 of these folks are 100% federally funded, and the balance are at about a 50-50 federal-state split. One thing here I might mention is that supplemental funding for this division has been requested to allow for the spring flood control activities on the Yukon, Kuskokwim, and other interior rivers. Division of Veterans Affairs has 2 employees and is fully federally funded. The Alaska State Guard is strictly a volunteer, no-pay organization, unless it's called to active duty by the governor. And the Naval Militia is a federally funded organization paid for by the Navy Reserve and the Marine Corps Reserve. In summary, the Alaska National Guard will have more than 4,200 members located in 92 communities spread throughout Alaska by the end of this year. Spending done by those members or in their behalf is a direct result of the federal dollars that are, in certain specific instances, tied directly to the state matching funds. We have over 1,000 full-time employees, of which 99 are state positions. The remaining 900 plus are civil servant and active duty guard people, spread generally as you see them on this map. We have nearly $500 million worth of equipment and facilities purchased and maintained using federal dollars. Civilian contracts are let almost daily to maintain these facilities and the personnel that operate out of them. I'll come back to that slide in just a minute as a wrap-up. When we invest in the training of these guardsmen, we invest in the growth and prosperity of these communities. All of these benefits are good for Alaska in our view, but they're not free. In order to sustain most of this federal spending, the state must fund their fair share or the ratio to ensure federal participation. To decrease the state funding to any proportionate or large degree carries with it the very real threat of losing federal assets, federal money, which is going to affect jobs, payroll, and impacts throughout the state. That pretty much sums it up. I thank you for the opportunity to be able to present this prepared portion, and I would like to go back and show you the breakdown slide here in just a second. This map is broken out by election districts, and it shows the its representative year, fiscal 1986. It shows where payroll money and contractual money for that year was spent. And backing up just a little bit further, this thing backs up. It's not backing up. Well, at any rate, the KC-135, that aerial tanker aircraft that I had a slide of, one of those is going to be in Juneau on Tuesday, the 27th, and it's coming up here as part of one of its routine training missions, and we're going to open it to the public so that if you have time from noon to about 4 p.m., That aircraft will be open to the public, and you can take a tour of it. It's a, let's say it's a tanker aircraft. It holds about 180,000 gallons of fuel and designed for aero refueling, as I said. It's an interesting aircraft. It's a military version of the 707. With that,
thank you, Mr. Ford. Let the record reflect that Vice Chair Lyman Huffman has joined us. Are there any questions for Mr. Ford? Yes, Mr.
Ford. Mr. Ford, I've seen the 1988 recommended budget that your department is slated for one of the few increases that are proposed this next year. In fact, it shows that you're going to be receiving approximately a threefold increase in your department, and I assume that a substantial portion of this is for disaster relief. It states in the proposed budget that there's going to be a $10 million allocation for disaster relief in 1988. Mm-hmm. Do you know how much funds were allocated in FY 86 and 87?
I think the figure you're using of a threefold increase includes that disaster relief fund money.
Right, it does.
And prior, in prior years, that had not been carried under the department. That's a result of some action that were taken, I think, last year, as I believe. I think really getting at your question is how much have we been hit in the operational money? Because the disaster relief money, we're not counting as operational money.
How much have you been being allocated for disaster relief in FY 86 and FY 87?
Had we been allocated?
Right.
We had not been allocated any because it was not a department bucket. It was located in the office of the governor, the disaster relief fund.
Are you aware of how much that might be?
What did that amount to? Excuse me, you have to go to the OIG.
The governor's office. The disaster relief fund has received appropriations from the budget reserve fund, or prior to that, the rainy day account. And each year, the governor had the ability to transfer $5 million from the rainy day account into the budget, or into the disaster relief fund. And those were the appropriations that we used to maintain the account.
My question is, is any of this $10 million slated for FY 88 to pay for past expenditures from disasters that have already occurred?
No. Because the disasters that have already incurred have had the money fenced based on estimates of the damage.
Any other questions? Representative Hudson?
Yes, Madam Chairman. I'd like to, I'm kind of wearing two hats when I came over here with kind of a strong interest, I guess maybe from prior associations as a cabinet officer and also as a veteran in the state of Alaska, retired Coast Guard commander. And as a former commissioner, one thing that always escaped me is why this cabinet level office was not situated down to the rest of the cabinet. It seems to me like we saw the adjutant general or the commissioner on an extremely infrequent basis. He was seldom at the right hand of the governor, which is, I think, in these real tough times when money's really low, we have much better coordination between cabinet level officers and this area. I'd like to compliment the department for what I think is an outstanding record of accomplishments. I think General Schaefer will be a wonderful new leader on the whole thing. I'd just like to see him sitting down here in the cabinet with the other cabinet officers and having the National Guard under proper military command elsewhere. I think there's benefits to that. There's also benefits, I think, to Alaska's veterans. Veterans that are basically being treated from a distance without close association with the governor's office and the other cabinet officers, I don't think have the direct entree into the political systems to look after the loans and all of those kind of things. I know that from your presentation or from John Schaefer's presentation that the veterans program consists largely of two people who are basically dispersing grant monies to various veteran agencies throughout the state of Alaska, and that's fine. But there are innumerable problems that develop that veterans have with other state agencies, for example, like health and social services, like medical attention, for example, loans and things of this nature. And so my input, I suppose, Madam Chair, would be to suggest seriously that at these times, that the department seriously consider establishing a direct presence at the cabinet table in Juneau. And you could do this over a period of time, since you're primarily using federal monies. It shouldn't cost a lot of money. And I guess that's the reason I came over, because I've observed this now for at least 4 years where I sat at the cabinet table, and only under a very, very extremely infrequent basis did we ever see. And I think that there's an awful lot of interaction that was missing in that respect. So I have to leave, and I hate to just sort of throw it out on the table, but I would very much appreciate it if the committee would look into that possibility and the pros and cons of that suggestion.
Thank you, Representative.
Would I be allowed to comment briefly?
Please.
With the with regard to the commissioner or the adjutant general being located here, we run into the real problem of where the feds are putting their dollars. We have a situation where the adjutant general is looked to by the feds to provide them a ready military force if they call up in a national mobilization. If he were located here with 11/12 of the activity north of Anchorage, or Anchorage and north, you have a perception on the part of the federal government that Alaska isn't doing its fair share in terms of putting it the proper attention at the highest level in order to maintain those units at the readiness state that the feds require. With regard to the other part of your question, and that, see, you had a two-part comment.
About veterans.
Yeah, veterans. Your point's well taken. When we assumed that division, we did not get any resources with it. It was under Health and Social, or Department of Commerce, rather. And it was a part-time or other duties as assigned position with an individual over there. And when we created it, we had to take it out of hide, so to speak. So that precluded us from doing any more with it in terms of numbers of people than we have. And certainly we're not looking at any more growth there. So what has driven its location there is largely putting it where the majority of the veterans population exists.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Hudson.
I would like still like to have it seriously considered.
Yes, sir.
I don't buy off on the fact that the feds can't interact with someone who is in the capital of Alaska rather than being up north. I'm convinced that DOT has 11/12 of all of their operations up north as well. But this is the capital. This is where the governor's at. If we ever had a disaster, I'd much rather have the adjutant general standing at the right hand of the governor rather than somewhere off up north. I'd also like to have him at the right hand of the governor if a major disaster occurred, such as wiped out bridges and sites throughout the state of Alaska in the last years here. So I think that I'd really like to have it looked into seriously. I have discussed this with John Schaefer. John has indicated some interest in looking into it. And for the record, I would like to have it observed, and I would suggest that we make this recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. Representative Menard.
Yes, as a representative from a little further north, I'd like to compliment you on the insight and wisdom of locating in the Wasilla area as far as upgrading. As you know, our area and the unemployment picture of the Mat-Su Valley is probably at the 20% level, and anything from your side is looked on with great favor. Plus the fact, I'd like to compliment the division on the help during the flood and the disaster area that we had. It was very beneficial, well organized, and had a lot of compliments.
Thank you.
Other questions or observations? I did see a hand from the audience.
Madam Chairman, Bob DePere, retired from the Alaska National Guard, affiliated with it since 1961. I'd like to comment on the Chuck Boggs's perception that the federal people have a vested interest or a proprietary interest of having it in Anchorage. That is not the history of the case. The reason why that commission's position was in Anchorage, it was more convenient then for the incumbent, who was a retired two-star general from the Air Force, to be located there, in spite of a staff study which was going to look at this thing objectively. and the actual forces. But the driving factor was the convenience of being near the PX, the commissary, the officers club, and the cronyism that comes with that. And that was the issue for the evening. And the second item is, there was has some indication that they appreciate the emergency office being up there. I'd like to inform him, the representative, that somebody from this recommended moving that emergency division from the Palmer area to Anchorage, among other things. And there was another discussion about moving administrative and support services from here to Anchorage. And the real question is who was the group who recommended that for the transition? Who recommended moving emergency services office?
Is your question to me, Bob?
Yes, somebody gave those recommendations to the transitional team.
Yes. I don't know. I testified before the transition committee, and I spent 3 hours with those folks, and all 3 hours were talking about budget. We did not get into any discussion where the operational entities of the division would be located. Now, there were several other people who did testify, and I'm sure that you know who they were, and what was said in that testimony, I have no idea. My boss, Commissioner Adjutant General John Schaefer, a member of that transition committee, might be able to shed some light on it, but I don't know the answer to your question.
Just for
as to who made recommendations.
Of clarification, Mr. DePere, the document that you are reading from, is that something submitted to the transition team or the report of the transition
team? That is the report of the transition team.
And I wonder if, would the committee be interested in seeing a copy of that? Would you like us to make copies of the proposed changes in location?
I would.
If you don't mind, Bob, sharing that with Dennis. Dennis can make copies for the committee of the transitional report with regard to location of offices for military affairs. Any other questions then, Mr. Ford? Yes, Mr. Davidson.
Madam Chair, Deputy Commissioner, oftentimes we without a military background run into misunderstandings and not being familiar with military protocol. And I just wondered if you could maybe expand on that for the benefit of us without a military background as regards to experiences in the state national government.
Sir, I'm not sure if I...
Well, for example, I had a constituent who said that there is quite a protocol involved in who we choose to head the National Guard, as reflects poorly, apparently, upon the state if we do not choose the right rank and level of person. And I was just wondering if, in fact, that is the case, and if so, what do you do about that if you don't choose the right person?
The individual who heads up the Alaska National Guard or the National Guard in any state is required to be of a federally recognized rank, which means that he has to be an officer in the ranks of the National Guard of that state in the federally recognized structure, which precludes you from going down to certain ranks and arbitrarily making somebody an adjutant general. While the governor has statutory authority to do that, the federal people on the other side, who are responsible for the dollars, won't recognize that, and you run the risk of losing federal participation in your National Guard activities in the state. Plus, in order to get these federally recognized ranks, there's a very, very rigid and strict schooling cycle one goes through in terms of advancement over the years. And it's necessary in order to properly administer a military organization that one has had those. And if you arbitrarily pick somebody, you take down the risk of him not having had those schools, improperly administering them. The guard activities run the risk of them not, the guard that is, not being able to maintain federal standards with regard to readiness. And when that happens, they lose a federal recognition, and when you lose federal recognition, you lose the dollars coming into it. So the picking of a commissioner or adjutant general of our department, really, I don't think is too unlike any other. The governor will go to probably the guard structure to look for the best qualified man with the appropriate military background in order to nominate.
Any other questions? Just one quick question. Are you anticipating many pieces of legislation from your department? If so, could you just tell us?
We have three. One has to do with exempting the state from liability on tort claims acts. Basically, we have a situation right now where if an individual went on active duty with the Guard, that is when he's still under the control of the governor but being paid by the federal government, injures someone, those parties can take the state and hold the state liable. There's precedents been set for that in Washington State. We have a piece of legislation now which would add the proper words to existing statutes to preclude that from ever happening. We have another piece of legislation which allows the Adjutant General to set the maximum age for those individuals in the Alaska State Guard. It's presently capped at age 59 or 60. As I recall, and this would allow expansion to that age up to 69 or 70, or as set by the AG. And that's only allowing for getting in that senior talent that an organization like that needs. At that age, you're sure as heck not over the hill. Another piece of legislation expands the definition of a veteran by approximately 1 year in the state statute so that it matches the federal statute's definition of a veteran, so that we have a match there in terms of the state programs and the federal programs being in sync. None of these three pieces of legislation carry any fiscal impact.
Any other questions? Any other public participation? Ms. Pair?
To answer the question about selecting the Guard and so forth, the Guard Association here before, the National Guard Officers Association, had made recommendations that the statutory standards set for the Adjutant General. And those were the field grade officer, 5 years experience in the Guard, and completion of 34 hours. Then he also had a recommendation have an advisory board. And one of the things that the advisory board could do on these transitional, this will take every 4 years, is that they would submit to the governor those people who meet those qualifications. The governor doesn't have to pick for those lists, but there's other people who meet those qualifications. In 1968, Mike Miller surveyed other states and found that 30 states had basic requirements for the Adjutant General, statutory requirements other than being a resident. And the advisory board and that particular Adjutant General standards was before the legislature in 1979 and 80. But the incumbent administration was a non-Guard person, and he said that, that's not the thing that the people want in the Guard. So that plus other aspects of the bill was surveyed, and out of 2,900 survey letters, 750 came back, and it was like 600 to 100 qualifications that were set out in the proposed bill for the Adjutant General, and a similar amount while setting up an advisory board to get balance into this thing from the grassroots people. If you notice, there's 4,000 people Guard, there's 1,000 full-time employees, and it's trying to get those other portions of the Guard represented in having a sound, more sound, democratic sounding board. You know how the military is? If you don't, believe me, it's not democratic. That's just the point of that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Pair. Any other questions? I would just like to look for a moment at the document which we've just received, apparently there are a number of proposals here, everything from moving emergency services from Wasilla to Anchorage, moving support services from Juneau to Anchorage, phasing out the bonuses, and consolidating some of the veteran services. Has either the department as a whole, or you, or Commissioner Schaefer reacted to this in writing? Have decisions been made about which, if any, of these recommendations would be accepted, or is it still everything on hold?
Partially. If I can pick out a few specifics, if you like, with regard to consolidating some of the veterans' activities, it talks about the Department of Labor being staffed with people who do veterans' employment work. That's being looked at right now, and a letter is being sent to the governor giving him a status report as to where that review is at this point. We're not ready to make a recommendation one way or the other on that. It appears that there may be some federal statute stumbling blocks on that, because veterans certainly, that contractual money to provide that service for veterans requires that it be with a labor service organization. Now, that's obviously the Department of Labor. If you can make a case for Department of Military and Veterans Affairs being a job placement organization, then that gives us something to go on. With regard to the movement of the Alaska Division of Emergency Services from Wasilla to Anchorage, that is being looked at with regard to how that might, such a move might improve the reaction and response. No decision has been made at this point. I don't expect a position on that to be forthcoming for a while yet, because that carries with it some fiscal impact that would require moving from one facility, which is cost-free up there in the valley, to some rental space in Anchorage, which is going to carry with it probably a minimum of $40,000 or $60,000 a year to rent appropriate space. So it's being looked at, no decision, and I don't really expect a decision for some weeks or perhaps months on that one yet. The question with regard to, and I don't have my glasses, I can't skim this thing very quick. There is one, I'm trying everybody's name. I'm sorry, Red. there was the bonus program. There has been a decision made on that with regard to paring down that program, or the eligibles for that program. That was submitted as part of our budget proposal. The governor has bought off on that proposal, and that will be going before the legislature. Essentially, what that does is take a $500,000 a year program, which provides for everybody, regardless basically of the number of years of service, and whittles it down to providing for those people who are first and second termers, that is, those under 12 years of service in the Guard, those people that we need to reenlist, and giving them or continuing their eligibility for the program, but eliminating those people with 13 or more years of service, and eliminating those people who are full-time employees of the department. As I say, the decision has been made on that, and the governor has bought off on that decision. That's the way it'll be portrayed in the budget. That, by the way, out of approximately $500,000 annually, would create a savings to the state of about $300,000, so roughly two-thirds of that appropriation. With regard to the recommendation on the Juneau operation, the decision has been made with regard to the budget, where we would transfer part of the personnel function to Anchorage to consolidate with an existing full-time personnel force there that administers the other 900 employees of the department, and place part of that personnel service where the majority of the people are located, and to eliminate one clerical support personnel in that end of the operation, the personnel services operation. It leaves the fiscal portion of our Juneau office intact as it presently exists.
So that's basically two positions leaving Juneau?
Yes, two positions leaving Juneau. One eliminated, one transfer, or authority to transfer, I should put it that way. This was just presented. The commissioner has not had time to digest this. He's been out on the Brimfrost, and while he is aware of this, both my conversations over the phone, he's still in the process of digesting this. It may be advisable to leave the personnel officer here. I don't know what his statement on that is going to be at this point. And I think that pretty much addresses all of the.
The position of special assistant position being eliminated, I guess that's a minor point. But has that been eliminated? That was the only other recommendation that I see here that you mentioned.
Yeah, yes, that has been eliminated.
Any other questions? Representative Davidson.
Yes, Madam Chair. My question, or I guess Commissioner Lord, is two. One, what was the rationale for eliminating the bonus for the 12 plus year veteran?
First of all, the rationale for eliminating those over 12, or recommending the discontinuance of eligibility for those over 12, a reenlistment bonus program is designed to attract people in who are thinking early on that they don't have anything to lose if they get out. It's felt and generally recognized in the active military the same way, that once a guy or a person goes over 12 years, they're over the hill. They made that commitment, and they're going to stay. If they get out, a few hundred bucks a year isn't going to attract them to remain if they feel that they should get out anyway. Bonus programs, reenlistment bonus programs, are designed for those, generally designed to attract those early-yeared younger individuals to make that commitment and get them beyond that point of no return. That was the rationale.
So it's primarily a financial commitment encouragement to reenlist.
Yeah, and while, yes it is, and while it's an unattractive option to take something away from people who already have something, the other option is absolutely horrid, and that is to take and, recommend for layoff an additional $300,000 worth of positions.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we are.
Any other questions?
And excuse me, that
yes.
Was one.
Sure.
Responding to the other part, federal approval for implementing any of the recommendations here. No, I don't think any of these recommendations are federal approval. It's all within the state authority, our authority to implement it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ford, for coming down.
Thank
giving
you.
Giving us a good briefing. I'm sure we'll be seeing you again before the end of the session.
Okay.
And please let us know if there's anything we can do to help.
Thank you.
The committee can take about a 5-minute at ease while the slide presentation is removed and while our 4 o'clock person arrives. So we can stretch our legs.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Department of Transportation and Public. And Susan Fleischhauer from DOT. Mike Miller would prefer to go first. He has something else he needs to do, so I thought we'd hear from Mike. The reason we invited Representative Mike Miller is because of the many, many years that he spent on the State Affairs Committee. And I thought it would be useful for him to just share some observations about the jurisdiction of the State Affairs Committee and maybe talk to us a little bit about some of the major issues that are likely to come to us based on his experience. So welcome back to the Hallowed Halls, Mike.
Well, thank you. Chair Elmer, it's always fun to get back, particularly this committee, because this, of all the places I spent time during the 16 years, I think some of the most pleasurable is in this very room, at this very table, and State Affairs is always really one of my favorite committees, just for the simple reason it covers so much of the territory. You never get bored with any one thing, because no two meetings were ever the same. I'm sure you've already taken my advice the other day and read the uniform rules, but Rule 24 indicates that the State Affairs Committee has jurisdiction over military affairs, the governor's office, administration, public safety, and DOTPF, with the emphasis on the PF, the transportation function, more or less is covered by the Transportation Committee, obviously. But the public facilities function, in other words, state buildings in particular, come under the jurisdiction of this committee. So as you can see, I haven't counted up recently, but I think there's 15 different departments in state government. I have 16 if you call the count of the governor's office, and five of them are under the jurisdiction of this committee. Four and a half, I guess, on DOTPF. But in any case, I don't think any other committee has anything like that many, portfolios to carry. Just when the confirmation time comes around, you'll be confirming. I mean, you'll be hearing, having confirmation hearings on more commissioners than anybody else. So you'll be confirming the new adjutant general of the National Guard, and unfortunately, you don't get to confirm the governor, but he's already been confirmed by the people. But you certainly will confirm the commissioner of administration and public safety. If the speaker polls to his usual practice, he'll assign DOTPF to commissioner to transportation for confirmation hearings. But if there was any reason you wanted to hear that individual too, you would certainly have jurisdiction to ask for that privilege. My usual observation was we were so doggone busy that anything like that we could let some other committee do, we were far better off. I don't know why I'm saying all this. Red here is an old hand at this committee and has been through the process and knows its jurisdiction very well, as does Terry Martin, who has served many years. Out of my 16 years in the legislature, I was on this committee, I think, 14 out of those 16 years, either as a member or as a chairman or as a vice chairman. And as I say, it's the one committee that I think I could probably serve on that many years and not be not get bored, because there's just so much here. I mean, people on transportation deal with nothing but transportation and resources, although they vary. You're still talking about basic resources, but guys, here they're covering the waterfront. You'll have not only confirmation on the governor's people, but in addition to the governor, the commissioners appointed by the governor, but you'll have also a whole slug of names submitted to you in the confirmation process for boards and commissions. And a bunch of those will fall under the jurisdiction of this committee. That doesn't mean that you will necessarily have to hold hearings or confirmation hearings on each of those individuals. But you'll be given a list, and Chair Ulmer will take the first cut, and if there's any that she sees that she particularly wants to have a hearing on, you can. And you'll probably pick out three or four that it just seems appropriate to hold hearings on. And then, of course, that same list, if the usual custom flows, the list will be available to everybody and anybody else on the committee that has somebody that they would like to have a hearing on. That's usually done. In fact, it's always done if somebody requests it. So just in the confirmation area alone, you'll be hearing a lot of people on a lot of boards and commission. In the area of heavy-duty legislation, some years, incidentally, this is true, in other years, it's not as true. But there are several categories that can get pretty heavy. Retirement is always a biggie. And if I were you, I would request the retirement division to give each of you the retirement handbook for public employees. Because the statutes, as statutes invariably are hard to read, but the retirement book that each public employee is given is written with ease of reading in mind. It's fairly thick, but it's reading that everybody can understand, and yet it's based on the statute. So if you go through the retirement handbook, you'll have a pretty good idea of what the retirement statutes say, even though it's more clearly written in the handbooks. And then, if you don't get some retirement legislation this year, it'll be the first year in 17 that you have it. In some years, it's really significant legislation, like last year, after. That's the only reason I felt like I could retire from the legislature, is the bill finally passed. For about 8 years, I was introducing legislation on automatic cost of living adjustments for retired employees, and we finally got that through last year. That was a major bill. To accomplish a seemingly simple thing like that, it took probably 25 pages, if my memory serves, of a copy that you had to make sure everything jives with everything else. And of course, it wasn't just as simple as that either. It, it did several other things. And then the bill went over to the Senate and picked up, since the subject was wide open, it picked up a whole lot of retirement items over there too, and came back. We had about a 40-page bill instead of the 25-page bill we'd sent over. And it's terribly important, because this retirement legislation, every time you change a comma or dot an I, you're affecting every public employee who is already retired or is, you know, hopefully going to retire from the situation at one time or another. Matter of fact, your own retirement system is in there too, so watch everything very carefully. And that's, since we had such a comprehensive bill last year, maybe the retirement bills this year will be more in the housekeeping nature, as they sometimes are. But at least be aware that if anything in the retirement area comes along, you'll get it. Personnel matters will come to this committee. I don't know what the status right now is on comparable worth. If that,
we did hear from the commissioner.
You did hear. Okay, yeah. That's another very heavy duty bill or it wasn't in bill form quite last year, or maybe it was. In any case, we didn't really move on it, and in the absence of moving on it, there's some court action that might take place. I don't know. I'm sure you've got briefed on that. We'll continue to get briefed on it. It's a somewhat controversial subject, and it's also somewhat costly. But of course, if the courts, for instance, mandate you to do it, then you don't even have any choice in the matter. So that could really be another heavy duty bill. In any case, though, personnel is at work, and anything having to do with the personnel board. The personnel rules that need to be changed by statute or whatever will have to come through this committee. Some years there's been a lot of flap on state buildings, given the state's finances this year. There probably won't be very many bills to build state buildings as such, although state might want to be getting back into the ASHA type construction mode again, where ASHA is a separate corporation, bills and rents to the state, and then the state pays rent to ASHA, the landlord. If they have, I've heard a little bit about that maybe happening, and if that happens, that bill should and undoubtedly will come to this committee. None of these, incidentally, are simple matters. But then again, that's kind of the fun of this committee. You really get involved. I mean, it's just not a matter of changing a line here and another line there. Last year, the most important bill that came to this committee, well, it's not necessarily the most important, but certainly one of the most important bills to come to this committee, unfortunately came, and we only had about 7 days, literally, maybe nine at most, left to deal with it. By the time it got here from the Senate, and that was the APOC rewrite. And APOC is badly, badly in need of rewriting. That bill was first introduced as a result of Citizens Initiative. It's been patched a little bit, but it seems like every time the bill surfaced, it got so politicized, so fast, and some people were just wanting to abolish the whole APOC, so the defenders of the APOC then would just take the strategy of just pulling the whole bill off out of contention, because they didn't want to see the whole Public Offices Commission destroyed. And the result is that APOC people, as I'm sure you'll hear later on, are working under a terrible hardship. They are having to write regulations around a skeleton that is anything but adequate. It badly needs to be rewritten. The Senate spent one whole interim and one whole session, minus about the 9 days that we had, getting that bill in shape. And they did some marvelous work. It was, overall, 95% of that bill was an excellent bill. Unfortunately, the 5% that was left would have been very unfortunate. I can't begin to get into the details now, but it was something we just couldn't let slide and patch later. And for a while, the chair of the committee, Katie Hurley, and a couple of others were trying mightily to put it all together, even at the last moment, and pass something that would at least be okay in that 5% area I'm talking about and not be destructive. However, it just couldn't be done. It was just far too important, and it was far too complicated. It was another one of these bills that you measured in centimeters or inches instead of in pages. And the result was everybody was just very nervous, because that's APOC is a very sensitive area, as anybody that's been observing the legislature for any time at all knows. I mean, there's all sorts of disclosure requirements, one thing, another, and you don't just tamper around on a casual basis with it. You need to know exactly what you're doing. The original bill, the original APOC bill, was very, what's a charitable word, amateurishly drafted, well-intended, but by citizen groups, and the legislature just sort of patched onto that poorly drafted beginning, and the result is it's very difficult to correct. I thought several times we just literally ought to just throw it out and replace it with something new and better, but that just doesn't ever seem to quite happen. But we came fairly close to that last year. The Senate approach was actually pretty good, and they worked hard. And Senator Fisher was over here working with Katie Hurley a lot. This is Senator Vic Fisher. And at first, he had started out being very lukewarm, in fact, even opposed to what was going on. But by the time it got out of the Senate, he was feeling real good about most of that bill. I suspect that you all will get a similar bill from the Senate again this year. Mitch Abboud, I think, was very much into that bill last year, and he'll probably just want to introduce what they passed and send it maybe back over to you. And you could do some marvelous work there if you wanted to look into it and get into the areas that need to be corrected. On top of everything else, a lot of money was spent, well spent, but a lot of money was spent with Avgros and Susan Burke, their firm, working as special counsel as contract counsel to the Senate State Affairs Committee, putting it all together. And again, that could really be a biggie. Those are some of the bills that might come floating around this year, some of the subjects that might come floating around this year. What's interesting about this committee is that anything that the Speaker doesn't know what to do with comes to this committee. And that's what I always really enjoyed about it, too. I mean, if it's something to do with fishing, obviously it goes to the Resources Committee or Special Committee on Fisheries. And if it has to do with airlines or something like that, it might go to, or highways, it'll go to transportation. But there's probably 10% of the bills that the Speaker has to assign every day. He looks over the list, and they just don't fit conveniently any place. And state affairs is a great catch basin for that type of legislation. And you'll get a lot of stuff. A lot of it will be bills that you can handle in 1 hour's time, and handle it thoroughly and handle it well in 1 hour's time. And those will be bills that you can feed to the calendar rules, particularly early in the session, but even late in the session too. It's always just hungry for bills they can put out on the calendar. You kind of get wrapped up in a cycle of, gosh, we've got to be passing some bills, because otherwise we're not earning our money. And that probably isn't a great mindset to have, but all of us have had it. I certainly did. And you just don't feel like you're earning your keep if you're not passing some bills. And this committee has the capacity to do some quality work in a fairly short amount of time for some of these smaller bills that can be moved right out. A whole bunch of them, of course, will have financial implications, and so they'll go from here up to finance. But even so, even finance likes a lot of the state affairs bills because they can be fairly simple financial implications too. A lot of zero fiscal notes and that sort of thing, or very minor fiscal notes, or even rarely and happily one with a technically a negative, but I always think of it as a positive fiscal note, meaning it saves money instead of costs money. And to me, that's just the great thing about this committee. You're just always going to be, every day is different. One day you're doing personnel stuff, and the next day you're doing state trooper stuff. Another day you're dealing with some problem that the governor's office has, and they'll be down here. I should have mentioned too, invariably there are election bills that come along. That falls into this category. And we refine and refine and refine the election statutes, and it still happens that you need to do something else each year. And that gets real controversial real fast, and it also gets complicated real fast. And, but it's very important. And I don't know what we did with your bill last year. I know we passed it out of the House. I don't know if it passed the Senate. It's, well, that's at least that much out of the way. We don't have to worry about it this year then. But it's, you know, that's another category. So I guess my advice is to, you know, arrive on time and just and look forward to a rich variety, because you're going to get it in this committee. And that's one of the reasons I enjoyed it so much. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Are there any questions? Anybody? I'd just like to ask a real quick one. The longevity bonus will definitely be before
yes.
this committee.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you had any words of advice based on your long experience with that subject. You don't have to answer the question.
My only advice is to just become as knowledgeable as you can, because that's another one of these really complicated bills or concepts. And everybody's got a different idea of what they want to do about it. And as you know, the Senate and the House were locked in a discussion last year to which there was no solution. So we did a crazy thing. We passed both versions, which are totally incompatible with each other, and then asked the people to sort of vote which ones they wanted, but made no obligation for us to go along with their vote. And in fact, even the vote, we didn't even say, that whatever vote takes, that becomes law. Actually, you can't do that. There's a constitutional prohibition of doing it that way. But the result is, you're right, you've got that bill before you again. And fortunately, you've got some real good people over in the administration that are real good about laying it all out step by step by step. And you'll, with some briefings from them and a little bit of reading, you'll know it pretty well. But it's definitely do your homework on that one, because that's one that that's very important. And don't even try to understand what we did last year.
Any other questions? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Miller, the matter of AIPOC, undoubtedly you've heard the governor's remarks as regards to campaign finance. Do you feel that this would have impact on the situation of AIPOC? Would it make the job a lot easier if we followed his course, or would there still be plenty to do on AIPOC?
There's going to be so much to do on AIPOC under any circumstance. There's just no ideal solutions to the whole campaign financing, and then of course also AIPOC also includes the campaign disclosure, mm-hmm. conflict of interest disclosure. And no matter what you do, you're going to have lots to do on AIPOC.
What words of caution would you have in dealing with AIPOC then?
Well, just, I've always been a super strong defender of AIPOC. I just really, in the first place, the people themselves wanted it there. At various times, the elections have been held, including here in Juneau, and in various towns, Fairbanks, various communities. I think even Kodiak, if my memory is right, about whether to require it of local officials, because that gives you at least a glimmer of what the people are thinking on this subject. And I think there's only been one place where they have opted not to require AIPOC disclosure. I think the people want it, and I think the people deserve it. I think people deserve to know what you're spending on campaigns, where the money came from, and I think that in the disclosure column, I think the people deserve to know at least, if not the details, and you don't get the details, but at least in general terms, where a candidate gets his or her income. And then if they decide that they're getting it in a way that they think is going to influence their decisions, that's something they can take into consideration when they cast their vote. I think it's very important not to weaken AIPOC. Last year, the big thrust was, the big debate was whether to raise the limits. Right now, anything over $100 has to be disclosed. They were, for instance, in the campaign disclosure, that we were going to raise it to $250. And I personally opposed that, although I certainly would not have voted against the bill because of it. I like the $100 limit. To me, $100 is still a lot of money. And I don't think anybody can be bought for for $107. But on the other hand, if somebody's given a candidate $100, I think it's public information. But that's just my view. And it's not the biggest thing. If the 250 had survived, I would have still said we did a good piece of business if we'd been able to pass that bill last year.
Well, which were the areas, but which were the areas where that 5%, what were the areas that 5% is the hang-up?
Yeah, I was afraid somebody was going to ask me. You know, I've been searching my mind when I was down here, and I can't recall. I just can't recall what it was that we felt was so distressing that we couldn't pass the bill. It wasn't simple, I can tell you that, because if it had been fairly simple, Katie working with Vic Fisher, but it was going to take some considerable rewrite, because it's one of those things where you can't change this line without affecting this line over there.
If it occurs to you later,
yeah,
perhaps you might just
give
us a call.
And another person who has instant recall on all these things, and I'm sure would be glad to share the information, would be Susan Burke, for instance. I suspect she'd even be glad to appear before the committee and give you a rundown, as would Ab Rose.
Any other questions? Yes.
Yes, Madam Chair. I think probably I would recommend that you read the work that was done last year. It was a little bit of posturing, rather the House version came out of the Senate version, and I think they kind of bumped into each other at the end. But the work that was done there certainly can be built upon, and it's all that information is available. Because we'll probably be having it before us again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyone else have any questions or comments? Thank you very, very much, Mike.
You're very welcome.
For joining us. We appreciate
good luck
it.
To you all.
We hope that you will always feel welcome to come back to this room during the session.
I would.
If there's
thank
an
you.
Issue, please, we'd like to hear from you.
Okay, great. Thank,
thank
you.
You.
Thank you.
See you
all.
Thank you.
See you Tuesday. Right.
I'd like to introduce Susan Fleischauer. She is here from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, and as we have
she'll give you good advice.
As we've just heard from Representative Miller, we won't talk about the transportation part of it, we'll just talk about the public facilities part of it. And Susan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Susan Fleischauer, and I'm the legislative liaison for Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. We understand that you wanted to discuss the public facilities aspect of DOTPUF, as we call it, as it relates to this committee. So actually what I've done is brought Rod Wilson with me today. He's the design manager for engineering and operations standards, and this is his specialty. So I think that he could give you much more information than I am to be able to answer any questions you have. So I'd like to bring up Rod. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representatives, I don't really know what it is exactly you want, so if you would kind of...
Sure. We're just doing an overview of all of the departments that have issues that come before this committee during the session, and we're all newcomers with the exception of Representative Boucher in terms of exactly which bills impacting public facilities might come before us, but we wanted to get some idea of the public facilities portion of DOT so that... when those bills arrive, we can deal with them expeditiously.
Okay, why don't I just give you kind of a brief overview of what the public facilities aspect of DOTPF really encompasses. The primary emphasis among public facilities, as Representative Miller indicated, are the public buildings. We also handle dock facilities among the public facilities aspects. We also, within the building's expertise, handle all the handicap access for basically all the four modes, including highways and aviations. We also administrate the Art in Public Places program, which was an issue last year. We are also required by statute to establish certain standards. We develop the standards in the energy areas as they relate to only public buildings. We also develop standards for space allowances within public buildings, i.e. how much space should a secretarial space have, or how much space should a director's office consist of. We also look at, obviously, the actual construction, design and construction of the public buildings, from their design concepts clear through to final completion of the facility itself. So in a nutshell, that's basically the areas that we cover. My speculation as to what might come before this committee this year probably will, well, I know our department has asked for some legislation dealing with handicap issues. I know that Senator Duncan has a handicap bill on his side of the legislation. There's undoubtedly going to be some activity in the Art and Public Places arena again. Those areas, beyond that, I honestly don't have any insight as to what might be coming up.
We'll take questions then. Representative Donnelly.
Do you have any, through the chair, does your division, or is it called a division, or is it part of the department? Or?
Engineering and Operations Standards is a division of the Department of Transportation.
Right. Do you also have the you don't have any responsibility then for the leasing of buildings. That's under Department of Administration.
No, that is under Department of Administration General Services.
Are there any state office buildings in Anchorage that are owned by the state, or are they all leased through Department of Administration?
I believe the aviation building that DOT is in out by the airport is an owned facility. I'm sure there must be some own facilities. We constructed the forensic lab there, for example, the records warehouse facility we just recently built. I'm sure there are numerous buildings that we actually own outright. There is quite a large preponderance of state leased space in Anchorage as well, though. If I had to venture a guess, and it's solely a guess, I would say that the lease space certainly outweighs the space that we own.
Thank you.
Do you by any chance have a list of all of the state-owned public buildings? Where they are.
We do have that on the mainframe. I believe planning could probably pull that, Susan. But yes, there is a master listing. It is extensively thick. There's something like 12,000 buildings on it throughout the state.
12,000 state-owned public buildings.
It is immense.
I'm amazed.
Now, you have to bear in mind that on that inventory are things like pump sheds in the bush and those kind of things, but I mean, it's enormous, the amount of facilities that are out there.
I will not ask you for a copy of that list, but it's just nice to know what's available in case somebody wants to get
now
a copy.
Now, that list also includes public schools. Now, when I tell you that it's a list of public facilities, they may not totally be state-owned. They are buildings that the state may have an interest in. In other words, if we granted money out for construction of a school, we probably have some information on that facility in our files somewhere.
Representative Donnelly, did you have another?
Well, what I was getting at, I wanted to learn more about how the state office system works in Anchorage, and if there's any reports or anything I could be reading to get up to speed on that. It's always seemed they move so much. Every 2 years, it seems like the offices are in a different place, and it must cost a fortune to always be moving them around. And if there's something out there that could bring me up to speed, I could read and do some studying background on that so I could ask some intelligent questions, I'd really appreciate it if you could send my office those materials.
I am not that familiar with the transitions that are taking place among the occupants of those spaces. Here again, I would speculate that transitional state is probably more highly frequent among lease spaces than it is among owned spaces. Typically, when an agency owns a building, they stay put. When an agency leases space within a building, if the guy down the street has a better lease rate, they move. So in that case, I would suggest that you contact Bob Link, and perhaps he could have a little bit of insight into that particular item.
Just as a point of interest, I don't know if there are other members of this committee that would be interested, but I would like to listen to Bob Link talk about lease space sometime, about how they make their decisions. And if the committee is willing, one day we'll just ask Mr. Link to come speak to us a little bit about the whole leasing process. Okay.
And I just really appreciate before that happened, if I had a chance to read up on it so I could converse intelligently.
Okay, Dennis, just you'd make a note of that, that we might ask Mr. Link if he has some information previous to the time that we actually hear from him so that we can get the information in advance. Representative Boucher?
I just want to know the number of Senator Duncan's bill.
Of Senator Duncan's bill? Senate Bill 1, I believe, Representative.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make the point that I think Representative Bonin's point on being up on leasing is very important, because sometimes it gets to be a real campaign issue, you know, various times.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative Davidson.
Madam Chair. Yes, Rod?
Yes.
I would like to know how a study is initiated for building a new facility. For example, in Kodiak, we got a nice study and design drawings, and we could have probably gone to bid, or you could have gone to bid on what was presented. And yet, there was no one on the city council at the time who knew much about these drawings, let alone giving permission to allow you to put it where you wanted to put it. And so I was interested in knowing, how is the process in an instance like that, i.e. a new landing facility in some port, initiated? Why did we get all of this information? Why had all this money been spent without having some basis of fact or approval within the receiving community?
My first assumption is that this was a study that was done by DOT?
Yes.
Okay. Somewhere along the line, there apparently had been a perceived need either within the legislature appropriating funds for that study or within the department itself, realizing that perhaps a new facility needed to replace an older or a non-existent facility. When the department undergoes a study of that nature, the planning department, of course, would look at the options that are available in that specific community based on the perceived need. Now, how the perceived need came about is something that I don't have a whole lot of experience about. It could have either been, like I said, a specific request from the legislature. It could have been a canvas that had been done of the community several years earlier, mm-hmm. In not such lucrative times, and then finally the need came to the surface again, and everybody says, hey, there's money, let's take a look at the possibility of getting that particular facility put in. Obviously, when the decision came around as to where the facility was going to be located, the physical constraints of the site, the proximity to the people that it was going to serve, and those kind of things all come into play along with zoning requirements, Corps of Engineer requirements and permits, and those kind of things. So it's not as simple as saying, I want the facility right here. There's obviously a lot of other agencies that either will say yay or nay as to your request, but I don't know if that answers your question, but it's not a clear-cut defined path in every specific instance. Oftentimes various projects will have various ways of ending up at the location that they do. Quite often as not, a lot of state-built facilities end up on properties that were previously owned by the state, or in one manner or another could be acquired for the state.
Madam Chair, then I would recommend that then in future situations like that, if a little history accompanies what you finally bring to a local governmental agency were to come with your plan, given the transient nature of local governmental officials, mm-hmm. then that would be very helpful and save a lot of confusion and misinformation, I guess, on the part of those who think something's just being done to them rather than being asked to cooperate with you to accomplish it.
The presentation that you're responding to, is it that it was provided by a consultant for the department, or was it a presentation put on by the department staff itself?
Well, I think it was by the department itself, and I
if I recall correctly, we got the, it was quite a lengthy study, and it was to make a roll facility in Kodiak for the ferry system.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that many people in the city council at the time were wondering, well, where did this come from? Who asked for this? And even members who'd been on it for, say, like 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for joining us. Susan, thank you for coming today. Sorry to keep you waiting.
All right.
Committee members, just one or two tiny announcements here. If you look at the schedule for next week, on Wednesday, House Bill 10 will be a teleconference. And for your information, it is to accommodate some individuals who've expressed an interest to testify on this bill. It will be here in this room, but just so that you know, there will be a teleconference. And on Friday, we will only be hearing HJR 1. We cannot hear HB 12 because a fiscal note will not be ready by that time, so we will have to delay that to February 6th. So on Friday the 30th it'll just be HJR 1, and if there needs to be an extension of time on any of the other bills that we're dealing with on Monday and Wednesday, we'll carry those over to Friday. Any other committee member comments, questions, or suggestions? Okay, then the meeting of the State Affairs Committee adjourns early. Happy weekend.
Thank you.
Oh yes, there's also a museum reception, don't forget.
From what time to what time?
Now.
Now?
4 to 6 at the museum, and it's usually a lovely party.
And
not to mention there's a great exhibit there.
There's also a reception.